Welcome to 80s Music Exposed, the podcast in which we review all the best albums of the 80s, one month at a time. We will break them down, give you the skinny, and duke it out over whether you should or should not dig these back out again. If you are ready for an 80s music deep dive, from Public Enemy to Wham, Eno to XTC, Madonna, hair metal, reggae, and all points in between, then crank the boombox, turn the Walkman up to 10, and ooh, let's go.
Welcome to Aldo Nova Exposed. Can you live this fantasy life? That's what I want to know. I'm your host, Henry.
And I'm Chris. And if you didn't get that reference, you're going to have to go Google that for a second.
That's a good way to open the show.
It is. It's
an
a great
obscure
way.
Reference.
Talk about a cold opening. Bam.
The cold open.
Megan, you're welcome to the show. You're joining us again.
Mm-hmm, I am. Yes.
Thank you so much. All the way from Michigan. I hope. Are you guys on a quarantine? We just went on a new one starting today.
I mean, I've been trying to be careful really like the whole time. So the fact that there's like another lockdown, it doesn't really matter that much to me because I was pretty much already doing everything, you know, already. So, and stuff is still open. I mean, you can do takeout from restaurants, which we try to do to like help out. And plus we don't have to cook as much then, but yeah, I don't know. It's hard to keep track of like all the lockdowns.
It's weird because now our pod, as we talk about like what's going on, it's going to go down in history. Anybody who listens to this 10 years from now, 15 years from now, is be like, oh, that's when they had COVID-19. That was a thing. You know, it's going to mark everything.
Well, I try to think about that now even. I'm like, what am I going to think about this year, like this time period, like 5 years from now? Because there's going to be like more stuff that happens, more stuff that... you know, more information that becomes available, and we could feel totally different about it in 5 years, good or bad.
That's right. Our perspective could change on it.
I think it'll be interesting that in 10 years, someone will listen back to this and go, what the fuck were these three people thinking in that shit year talking about 1982? But that's what we're doing.
Anything that you can get like enjoyment out of this year and it's not hurting anybody, I say go for it.
I say let's let it happen. Yeah.
It's a shit year, so we just got to get through it.
For sure.
Welcome to all of you here in 2020 who've decided to join us. This is actually a show called 80s Music Exposed, and we review records on this show.
We do.
Generally speaking, we do 5 records every month, and we've been reviewing records since January of 1980. But this is another one of our sort of specialized shows. This is the third one we've done. Is that right? The third classic album show. This is the first classic album show we did was Grandmaster Flash. And then we took a look at Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. This time we're taking a look at Duran Duran's 1982 record, Rio.
That's right, because it kind of felt weird, Henry, and when we started in 1980 and 1981, some of those records are so well-received that it was weird putting them in with a bunch of other records and saying, okay, now I'm going to review you know, some super classic records. So we thought it might be better just to cover some of these all on their own episode.
This is weirdly like the first one that I actually remember when it came out. Like, I didn't know Nebraska when it came out. I knew that Grandmaster Flash had a record with a song on it back then, but I didn't think of it as an album. This is the first one that I actually knew of the thing and have some familiarity with it.
These albums are all so different from each other too. Mm-hmm. 3 of these albums, like Nebraska, going from Nebraska to Rio is quite the transition.
All right. So Megan, what is your first memory of Duran Duran?
That's hard to say. I mean, I grew up I was a teenager in the 2000s, basically. Mm-hmm. So at that time on VH1 and like networks like that, they had a bunch of like the I Love the 80s shows and then like the flashback, like the vintage MTV videos. So I think probably like through like those kind of channels and plus my parents, like their music choice, because they were, you know, young in the 80s. So I'm sure they probably had this on cassette guaranteed.
But so you probably heard the album maybe before you saw the video, right?
That I don't remember. I feel like it was definitely, they're so visual. They're such a visual group. Like, I probably saw a video. Like, that was most likely the first time that I had heard of Duran Duran, which fits, I think, perfectly, because they are such, when I think of like 80s, you know, MTV, I think of Duran Duran as one of like the big bands, because they were kind of like designed to be like, they're not one of my favorites, but.
Interesting. Chris, did you, what was the first video you saw of Duran Duran?
So that's kind of interesting. I saw my, I had an older brother, of course, who we had kind of heard about Duran Duran before. From the first album, but we had not seen any videos yet. But we'd heard this crazy rumor that there was a bunch of videos for the first album that were pornographic. And so piqued my interest, of course.
In the 80s.
Yeah, and I'm like 9 or 10 at the time, so that's crazy to me. But my brother got a hold of a VHS tape with those videos on it. So my first exposure to them was a mildly X-rated video for every song on their first record. Which, of course, then I went out and got the tape the next day. They were my favorite band. And Rio, like you said, Henry, is the first album. I know exactly what I went the day it came out to the record bar in the mall at the store and bought Rio. The interesting fact for, I think, our generation, and I don't know, it's hard to put across, they shot three videos for this album with an actual film director on 35mm film on location in Sri Lanka. The Hungry Like the Wolf video, which kind of looks like a Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of thing. That was not actually being done at that time because MTV had just started. And a lot of the videos, if you remember, on MTV looked like, I don't know, like they were shot on video camera type footage.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, like videotape. Yeah.
So when these videos hit MTV, I don't even know how to get across, at least where I was. It was a stop what you were doing and go watch it thing every time it came on. So like all the kids in my neighborhood, we had MTV on at every house all the time, like our radio. But when a Duran Duran video came on, you would run to the TV because it was like watching a good film as opposed to just watching a crappy video. For me, I think that's what turned Duran Duran into what they are. Just like Megan said, now I don't know that a lot of people know their records and all that as much, but this was a cultural phenomenon.
Even closer.
course. Mm-hmm. Like Patrick Nagel, who's one of my favorite artists. Like I have some right. Patrick Nagel prints.
Yeah.
But like that being, it's just so they like this album came out at the exact perfect time. Like it was everything was perfect for it to be like a success, I feel.
I totally agree.
I had an ex-girlfriend who had all these prints of all these Nagel prints. Mm-hmm. In the house, all of them were females.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're very female.
A very distinctive style, right? Mm-hmm. The guy that designed the cover of Rio was a guy named Malcolm Garrett, and he did the cover of like the Buzzcocks Orgasm Addict record. He did Simple Minds, but he was like when you think of 80s design work, where you would see graphics where the picture seemed to float over the page, like would have a shadow on
it. Yeah, it would have depth.
You know,
like a depth.
Yeah, it has some depth. Mm-hmm. He was the guy that kind of made that popular. If you look at the back cover of Rio, he thought of the front and the back as one piece of work. So you could flip it over and the little label that's on the bottom right hand corner wraps around. And you look at the back and you see another sort of overlaid picture with all these graphics. It is textbook graphic design of the 80s. Like that typified that exactly.
When it came to the Rio album, we decided we wanted a painting on the cover. It was actually our manager, Paul, who was an avid reader of Playboy magazine.
The letters page, they always used, they always had a little illustration about that big by a guy called Nagel, artist, who, you know, Paul tracked down and found working in Los Angeles.
And we approached him to potentially do something for the cover, and he came back with two designs for us, of which we chose the smiling girl that became Rio.
They caught lightning in a bottle. Like Megan said, everything that they did on this, I think, was perfect for the moment and the time, not just musically, and we can get into this too, but like from where they came from and what was going on in England and Birmingham at the time.
Like, right.
And it was perfectly marketed. Capitol had already figured out that they sold more records of bands that they had videos on by the neighborhood. Like they could narrow it down to the neighborhood who had MTV and who didn't based on record sales.
Yeah, he said it was even almost to the street. You could say these people on this side of the street had cable already and these folks didn't, which I think
like,
is so interesting.
Isn't that crazy? Like this is pre-computer, you know?
Pre-internet. That's the the biggest distinction, and that's why MTV was so important.
And it didn't.
That was where you got music videos.
And it didn't hurt that they were like handsome as hell, like all of them were, you know? They were not hard to look at.
Well, and their style, they were styled perfectly too, like for the time. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know who did, like who made those decisions exactly.
The guy that designed the suits was a guy named Anthony Price. Guess who he dressed also? I'll give you one guess. Roxy Music.
I was about to say because...
I was going to say Brian Ferry. Yep.
I also think going back to the cover, that the cover of the album to me reminds me a lot of the feel of Roxy Music and their art design, even though it's different. But I think they, to me, Duran Duran was the 80s extension of 70s Roxy Music. I think they were heavily influenced by them. They thought of themselves as that, as like art rock kind of stuff. So they were as surprised as anybody by the pinup boy teenage girl thing that happened. They didn't really expect that. They were doing more like what you said, Megan. They were going more on style and the new romantic thing than they were like, oh God, we're going to be on the cover of Tiger Beat magazine or whatever.
And now that you mention it, you can totally tell that Simon Le Bon was trying to be like Brian Ferry.
Oh, for sure.
Like he's like a baby Brian Ferry.
Yeah, you know, I wondered about that. Isn't it true that Duran Duran like inducted Roxy Music into the Hall of Fame or something?
I don't remember who inducted it.
And of course, I'm always proud to say that without Roxy Music, there really would be no Duran Duran. For sure. Sad but true. Along the way, in the early 80s, we were inadvertently able to introduce Roxy to our young American audience. When radio stations like WLIR would play, would play both bands back to back.
Roxy Music's influence is immense and impossible to calculate. We're happy to see them here together tonight and honored to be the ones to bring them into this hallowed institution. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to induct into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Roxy Music!
The guy that produced the record was a guy named Colin Thurston, who like co-engineered Heroes with Tony Visconti. He did Lust for Life. He worked with Magazine. Do you guys remember Magazine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he produced the first Human League album. He did a Talk Talk record, Chris.
Woohoo!
And then he did Kaja Goo Goo, but I won't hold that against him.
Right, right.
It's the 80s.
Yeah, it's the 80s.
Said that Duran Duran, well, Roxy Music basically proved that you could be a style band and be good. Yeah. You know, that you could have nice suits and dress nicely and be good. But Duran Duran did something that Roxy Music didn't do, which was like they dialed that pop sensibility in like dead on perfect.
Right.
You know,
Roxy Music is definitely way more artsy, I feel like Duran Duran. Like Duran Duran mm-hmm. for sure wanted to be Roxy Music.
Yeah, but they
so
weren't
bad,
they weren't as mature though, I don't think.
No.
And I don't know that they like, I don't know if you guys got this when you were listening track by track, and maybe this would come up, but it was you could the youth of the record just popped off. Like you could tell these guys were in their early 20s. With every note and every time the guy opened his mouth. Did you guys feel like that?
Well, that's something I think is good or about this record, because I listened. So I went forward as well to try to figure out why I don't like many Duran Duran records after these. And you just nailed it, Henry. There is a, you can hear it. There's this youthful vitality in the first two albums, even like the ballady song. Like it's still like it's still popping off with this like youthful energy.
Street and the lights are flashing on.
I know a lot of people like their later album called Notorious as a better 86. Album. And maybe it is a better album. I'm not sure. We can talk about it when we get there. But it does not sound, that energy is not there. They sound like a band that knows what they're doing, but they sound a little bit older and they, you know, more. That energy on Rio is so important to it. And I can't stress this enough, the context of where they came from. They were in the middle of Margaret Thatcher's early 80s tearing down of England. There was high unemployment, lots of bad stuff going on. Nobody could even travel very much. Nobody had a lot of money at the time. And these guys were from Birmingham wearing super colorful suits, doing videos in the Bahamas or in the Caribbean and Sri Lanka. They're making happy pop music.
Yachts.
Yeah, yeah. And they said they were doing that on purpose. Shows. It was almost like rebellious to be happy and to give people an escape.
What they were showing to Britain was, you know, this newer world. Very cleverly, in my view, showing it.
And punk was fantastic to photograph, but because it was very graphic and black and white, really, for me. I mean, virtually all my punk pictures are black and white film. And with Duran Duran, it's going from black and white to colour. And the country and the population was going from black and white, the black and white of the recession, the unemployment, and then the Falklands War. And they were preparing to bring the colour back into everything themselves. And I think that was the contrast.
In as much as the Sex Pistols drag you back to a sense and a moment in time, Duran Duran do too.
You know, they were saying in that documentary they didn't know how this worked either, because like the rhythm section is trying to be a funk band. The keyboard player is definitely trying to be an arty, Roxy Music guy. The singer wants to be David Bowie. And then they brought in this guitar player from Newcastle, which is far away on the other side of the country. And I don't know, Henry, if you saw this, but in the documentary, every one of the other guys always says he played angry guitar. Like, they don't even understand Andy Taylor at all. None of them liked him or, like, really hung out with him.
Okay, so I thought I was going to be the only one to bring this up. I thought I might have to fight you both on it. Okay, so Andy Taylor. Okay, I'm just going to say it. I don't think he was that great a guitar player.
You may have to fight me on that, because I think he's a really good guitar player.
I'm saying he's not a gunslinger, right? He plays for song. You listen to those licks, man. He played licks that were not for the most advanced people in the room. And I say that as such, in the band, he stood for the approachability of that music, right? The guitars were, it was very simple guitar lines with some slabs of chords here, you know, in the right places. He didn't overplay. I don't know if he didn't know how to play or he wasn't flashy. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It makes sense. It's wrong, but it makes sense. also, he's gonna be on an album here soon, a Power Station album, where if you want to hear flashy guitar, the guy's like finger tapping and doing all the stuff that 80s guitar players do. But I don't think there was a lot of room for that on Rio. I think he was doing as much as he could get in. It's interesting because I went into this assuming that all three of us would love this record, and my wife said before we started, she didn't think that was going to be the case. And I was like, who doesn't love Rio? Like, how can you not like Rio?
It's like asking somebody if you like, you know.
I don't like ice cream. I don't
I love Rio. I don't love Duran Duran. I like Duran Duran. Like, I think they're good, that's, you know.
I think that's totally fair. I don't know that they have more than two or three really good records. I think this is their only great record. And I think part of it is they caught lightning in a bottle. I think it's the perfect record for the time.
It has probably two of their best songs they ever wrote of all time on it.
Oh, definitely. It's their, like, I mean, I don't know how the band feels about it, because when you mentioned Notorious, like, I feel like that youthful energy, like, I almost feel like Simon Le Bon, like, they wanted to get rid of that to, like, change into, you know, more mature band, like, maybe. And I don't think that worked as well, because Duran Duran has such that energetic feel. And this album, I mean, this is their career. This is what people think of, especially with the album cover being so iconic, too.
I think that some of the themes that I heard on the record seem to make me think that the band knew they were going to be successful before they were. Like, it almost seemed inevitable like the even the title track, like Rio, is about America, really. It's about the Rio Grande.
You guys picked up on this. As a bass player, to me, Rio the song is my favorite pop bass line, period. But yeah,
I had no idea he was that. Okay, I didn't listen to bass playing back when I was 11 12, right? Now I'm putting the record on with like the beats in my ear and I'm like, that guy could fucking play.
He's an amazing bass player. It is kind of weird that like a band in Birmingham in our early 80s, which is like not got a lot going on, has four guys that want to start a band and they're already finding guitarists from across the country. So it's like they must have had something going on in a pretty decent way to have people come from around the country to audition.
Some sort of connection of some kind too, even if it was just somebody who owned like a club or whatever. Like at that time, I feel like that meant more, you know, because you didn't have the internet. You didn't have like these easy ways to find people. So if you had like, you know, those connections to the music industry or something, you could really use those. And if you're hungry enough, which, oh God, I guess hungry like the wolf.
Oh, nice. There you go.
Wow. I just got this call and he said, I'm the manager of this band called Duran Duran and they're causing a bit of a stir in Birmingham and I really think you should come and see them. And I, first of all, I was a bit dubious because I thought, well, you know, Birmingham, can't be anything going on in Birmingham. It's all happening in London.
So Betty came up and it was, you know, it was like a state visit, you know, because Birmingham didn't have... it wasn't very well represented in the national music media, Birmingham.
I was just blown away by their self-confidence and enthusiasm and just their complete assurance of what they were doing. They were just so confident about who they were, what they wanted, where they wanted to go.
If you look at Simon Le Bon's lyrics and writing, he was a seriously good
writer.
Even
the name,
writer.
Simon Le Bon.
Okay, so
I know, I'm with you.
That is actually his damn name.
I know. Isn't that weird, though? I know, but I have so much trouble taking him seriously. I'm right with Megan on this. But then you watch the documentary and you're like, that poor guy really was trying to be serious.
I believe it for sure. Like, I understand. It's just kind of funny because it's like, yeah, you're not Brian Ferry. Yeah. Like,
and let's all be honest, the first time we ever heard his name, we were like, that can't be that dude's real name. There's no way. His name's Simon Le Bon.
He's the guy you want to punch in the face.
Tell me, because, like, I wasn't alive then, but, like, at that time, was Duran Duran, I'm assuming they were viewed as, like, a girl band, like a, you know, a band that girls really exclusively like.
See, that's what I thought. The girls were in middle school, would wear, like, the Duran Duran t-shirt, and I thought, oh, that's a girl band. The girls like that band.
That's why you thought it was a girl band, though.
Yeah, plus their hair was perfectly coiffed. I did notice that.
Now, see, I took it the other direction. Like, we all wanted to be that because we thought the girls did like it. So it made it safe for a lot of us nerdy guys to be like, oh, we can take a different direction than trying to play on the football team. And well, it was popular. You know what I mean? It was actually popular. So I think they opened a lot of doors for a lot of us at that age to see different stuff, just like Culture Club. I mean, MTV opened our eyes to a bunch of weirdo stuff.
Well, that's what's so funny about, like, the fact that what we're talking about is the early 80s, and mm-hmm. people were so, compared to now, so close-minded. I mean, I know we still, like, there's still a lot of work to be done, whatever, but, like, the fact that androgyny was so big
right.
in, like, music and pop culture, it's so weird because it's, like, people in general didn't seem as accepting of things like that. I mean, it's good. Maybe that's how it had to be expressed. You know, it had to come out in different ways. I don't know, but it's just funny to me.
Well,
like, you got Duran Duran, they're wearing makeup, and they, you know, have the perfectly coiffed hair and in the early 80s.
And the American market is so... it's so different than, like, England because of the geography. It's so big. But if you think about it, we thought of England at that time. England was glam rock and all that, and it was great. It was everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was in New York and L.A. here. So yeah. So they talked about when this record came out, before the videos came out, they literally were like, this is not going to sell in the Midwest because people in the Midwest are going to freak out when they see these dudes wearing makeup and all that. How are we going to market this to the Midwest, you know? Like, that's a serious consideration. And then the videos just wipe that out. And all of a sudden, everybody in the Midwest is like, and I remember Madonna did this as well. Like, all of a sudden, you know, I'm in East Tennessee, not a bastion of liberal, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, every girl's wearing, you know, their bras on the outside of their shirts and, like, garter belts and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And it's like, It really took care of itself. It's interesting, like, you know, how marketing people were getting so worked up about stuff. And it was like, it's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, I was a little redneck kid in Eastern North Carolina. I hadn't been to a big city. And so it was truly exotic to see these guys on Hungry Like the Wolf, English guys in another country messing about in Sri Lanka, good looking fellas. And I was like, is that what the rest of the world is like beyond my little podunk corner of the world?
And isn't it, it's also, I keep going back to Megan's lightning in a bottle comment, because they said that those suits that they wore, the colorful suits they wore in the Rio video, were made for a video that they were going to shoot in England. They were actually just on vacation at the time, and somebody, the light bulb went off at the record label, send the guy down there to shoot videos down there. And that was the only clothing they had because they sent it with the guy to make the video.
So it was just lucky.
It was total luck that they're all that they're all wearing these Miami Vice looking pastel suits.
That's what they reminded me of. I was just going to say, I'm like, those are my, even the shoes, like the like slip on or loafers with no socks or whatever. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's total Miami Vice, right?
When you guys were listening to this, did you keep coming across, like, the idea of it, of Duran Duran being a new romantic band never even occurred? That wasn't even a word in my life back then.
What band do you consider the definitive new romantic band?
I always think when somebody says that, I think of Adam Ant.
I don't either. I think of ABC.
That's just who I think of.
I think of ABC and Spandau Ballet.
Mm. Okay. I think I lean more towards, like, Chris, like, your picks, because it's that really, like, the soul, like, the blue-eyed soul kind of thing.
Which
but I could see Adam Ant, but, like, just because of the style.
Which, Megan, like, I think is going to be, interestingly, what, going forward and listening just for this record, when we get to Notorious, that's what Notorious to me was going for. It's got these horn breaks, which I can't wait to hear what Henry thinks of. But it's, like, produced by Nile Rodgers. It sounds like Blue Eyed Soul to me. And they got rid of Andy Taylor at the time. So there's only three of them left. The drummer left too.
Well, but, I'm not going to like that already.
Well,
I don't.
But this record is not at all New Romantic to me. It's a funk rhythm section with a pop guitar and a cool keyboard all blended together into its own little thing. It's not New Romantic at all. In my
book.
Weird,
because everybody says that that's, they typified that, that they were the leading, they basically sold the New Romantic thing to America.
But I think it's the look.
Aesthetically only.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Megan's right. It's the aesthetic. And these guys will be the first to say as well that Duran Duran is not just the music. It was on purpose, the whole package. Like the way they looked, the way they acted, all of that was part of it. And I mean, it's kind of, to me, it's lazy to call it New Romantic just because they were wearing suits.
So what was your favorite song on the record?
My favorite song, and actually my favorite Duran Duran song by far, is Save a Prayer. And the only reason is I'm not a big ballad guy, but that energy you talked about, Henry, that youthful energy, even on a ballad, it sounds like these guys are chomping at the bit. Like, it sounds like these guys are like shaking and like they're high on.
All right. So, you know, the bendy thing on that song,
right?
It's the, that note bender where it goes, da-ya-na, for some reason, that song reminds me of it. It has the same vibe as Africa by Toto in a little at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, just the same feel of it. Which was your favorite one?
And aside from Rio and Hungry Like the Wolf, I like The Chauffeur a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to pick.
Yep. I think that's my favorite. Aside from the giant, like the two giant massive hits. You sit beside me, so new and charming. Sweating new drops glisten, flashing your side. And the sun drips down, bedding heavy behind the front of your dress, all shadowy lined. And the droning engine throbs in time with your beating heart. Way down.
Western Isle. My envy lady holds you fast in her gaze, and the sun drips down, bedding heavy behind the front of your dress, all shadowy lined, and the droning engine throbs in time with your beating heart.
Why did you like it?
That's another one. I really like the video for it.
Catch the video.
It's pretty good. It's pretty like racy, really, for, but again, that kind of goes with like what they were going for, the sexy, arty sort of thing. But I think it was Billy Idol's girlfriend is the woman in the video at the time, because she was a choreographer. She actually played a big part in a lot of the 80s like music scene for videos and stuff. So she was involved with that. But the song, I don't know, it's a little bit different. Like,
yeah,
it's not
dark. It's dark and kind of obtuse, you know.
That song is weird and fucking dark. Yeah,
but all that stuff that we're talking about, keyboards and guitars and the drums and all that, great. Duran Duran was made because Simon Le Bon knew how to harmonize with himself on vocals.
Well, and I know that he really admired David Bowie, and I think Chris mentioned like earlier, like Simon Le Bon wanted to be David Bowie, and I don't know, ever since I found that out, how much he idolized, because I think they did a cover of Fame too. I don't know what album, maybe that is Notorious too, but it's like I had never really made the connection before, but I can, in some ways, when he's singing, I can kind of tell that he's trying to do a little bit of his own version of Bowie, not like Peter Murphy, who is like straight up trying to be David Bowie in terms of vocals. But so it's just interesting how many people Bowie influenced, especially in the 80s.
Megan, I wanted to applaud you. I just went and looked up. Man, this is some deep Duran Duran shit.
Yep.
The Fame cover was a B-side to their second single off the first album called Careless Memories.
Oh, damn.
Nice get.
Damn, girl.
You've never heard that song?
I think I have, because I own that tape, the first album, but I didn't know. I don't have the B-side. Nice. But I do think it's sad that they ended up breaking up the original five as soon as they did. I guess the next record's really the last one that they did together. But Henry, I don't know if it was made a big an impact on you, but when the last song that Andy Taylor was actually on that they released was right after Seven and the Ragged Tiger. It was the View to a Kill, the James Bond. And to me, that is like classic Duran. Like that to me was like, oh, they're getting better. This is great. And then they break up, and then the three of them do Notorious, which is like, I don't know. I'm not a big Notorious guy. A lot of people like it, but it definitely doesn't sound like a View to a Kill.
But I love a View to a Kill.
I do too. And I think Simon Le Bon is at the top of his game in that one. Like it's like so confident. That song is, it's almost like he's James Bond in that song. It's like, it's so confident and cocky.
Meeting you with a view to wake.
face to face in secret places, feel the chill.
Feel like they've set up the ball so that I can't listen. The next record is going to be too slick and I'm not going to like it. This was like the best sellout record, kind of. I don't know if sellout, but you know, like it had the kind of guitars that are, it just sounded just edgy enough.
I feel like
if the next one, I'm not going to like.
So
like
it. My mother bought a Rio for me because she thought it was cute that, all the kids were way into MTV and all this stuff. She did not like Seven and the Ragged Tiger, so I had to buy it with my own money. And
is it good?
Listen, I had to like it, whether I wanted to or not, because I paid for it myself. So I'm going to defend Seven and the Ragged Tiger, God damn it, when we get there, because shit, I had to listen to it over and over and over because it's all I had, all right? I used my own money on that one, okay? Damn it.
Well, I will say that in my research, I found out that Milton Bradley did a Duran Duran board game.
What?
Really?
That somehow made it to my notes. I was going to try to work it in here somehow.
I'm going to have to look it up on eBay.
I had to tell you that was a thing, that happened. Also, another little tidbit, the guy that directed Hungry Like the Wolf was a guy named Russell Mulcahy.
Yes.
He also did Highlander.
Yes. And I think Henry, he said he really was a person that wanted to make full length movies and they wouldn't let him. So that's the only reason he made these videos, because no one would give him the money. And because of these videos, he got to make Highlander. So he kind of back ended to his way into it. And I'm glad he did.
Anyway, big thumbs up for this record, Rio, and my new guitar hero, Andy Taylor, if you're out there.
I was shocked that we had this much to talk about for Rio. Like, I didn't really know. I feel like they're kind of, I view Duran Duran as sort of fluffy. Yeah. And so after, like, Nebraska, especially, that last one episode special thing, it's like, but we did it. I mean, it was pretty fun to talk about.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because I think going forward, we're going to see a lot of the records that we cover as one-offs, which were huge, impactful records. Some of them are going to be like these deep, artistic, and some of them are going to be just like, man, that album just took everybody by storm, you know?
Yeah, well, let me ask you guys this. Like, is there a world in which we do a classic album that one of us just hates? Like, is not gonna.
I hope so. I
you know, like, I, sure it's not. Hard because will you constantly be looking for a reason to like it, or will you be prepared to come in and say this record sucks?
True.
I think that will happen, because I think there are some really popular records that we have to give the devil their due and cover on their own, and we're gonna say the three of us might not all love it, but so yeah, there'll be moments, Henry. I tell you, at the time, I was not a huge Michael Jackson fan when I was a kid, but who can deny Thriller, right? Like,
well,
you have to talk about it.
It's going to be weird, man, coming up in a couple months.
Right.
But that's it for our classic album show. The next podcast that you'll be seeing, listeners, will be five records from September of 1982. We'll be listening to It's Hard by The Who, High Adventure by Kenny Loggins.
I know you can't wait to get to that one.
The Dreaming by Kate Bush.
Mm. Mm. Signals by Rush.
Yeah, and Security by Peter Gabriel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm.
If you like our show or you like the records we're choosing, please rate and review us on iTunes. You can also, please, I mean, would it kill you to rate us on iTunes? Would it? I mean, it's right there.
I don't use iTunes.
Click on the thing, people.
Do they say something? Henry, can I interrupt right here a second? Do they still call it iTunes or is it called Apple Music now?
Hey guys, click and review us on
Apple Podcasts. Yeah.
It really helps us out a lot.
None of us use it, but none of us use it
the wrong direction the whole time.
We don't ask you to pay.
That's why we haven't got any
record. We don't make you listen to the record. Also, if you could listen, if you hear us on Spotify and Stitcher, you can hear us on YouTube. Share it with your friends. You can chat us up on Twitter at 80s exposed or at 80s music exposed at gmail.com. My Twitter handle is at Hank G. What is yours, Chris?
I heard that Hugh had a great tube. Did anybody else hear that?
What's your tube?
My Twitter handle is at TCI Duke. D-U-K-E.
I don't have a Twitter.
We make Megan every episode we make her say, I don't have a Twitter handle.
Well, I just feel like I have to say it.
It's because we're shaming you into a Twitter handle.
All right. So you can find me on Instagram at bastardsofyoung92 or on Facebook maybe at Megan Therese. I almost said my full name again on accident, but I caught myself.
You probably beep that.
I'm gonna make her a Twitter handle. And then when the pause comes, I'm just going to say it, whatever I think it is. It's going to be great.
Like flat
my line. Twitter handle would be, I don't have a Twitter.
I don't have a Twitter.
I don't have a Twitter.
At Hughes Tube.
I mean, if you would like to manage it, feel free. Right. I give you full permission.
I'm going
to
curate. I'm going to curate Megan's Twitter feed.
Oh, no.
Hey, guys, guess what?
What's that?
What?
I made you a mixtape.